So you want to take it away?
Yeah. Hello, I'm Simon Mercif, and welcome to the 2018 season of Crave, the podcast dedicated to music and film and theatre and television and just about anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And with the movie awards season already well underway, we're taking a look at a couple of films that are gaining some serious recognition.
Yes, indeed. For example, the Golden Globe winning Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
We've got the Street Hanks collaboration, the first ever apparently, actually, who'd have realised? But the first time is Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks have been on screen together in The Post, the political thriller directed by Steven Spielberg.
And we're looking at writer-director Guillermo del Toro's dark fantasy romance, which is called The Shape of Water.
Now, for some light relief, I'm not quite sure this is going to have the same awards buzz, but, you know, worth a look. We've got Hugh Jackman to turn as P.T. Barnum in The Greatest Showman.
And then for something completely different, that line's been used before, actually.
Yeah, hasn't it?
Anyway, we're not talking about the cinema, but why I think David Letterman's return to the small screen certainly featured a big coup, but still, it was a disappointment.
Yes. Right. So let's start with a movie which has already won Best Picture, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor nods at the Golden Globe, quite deservedly as well. And it's picking up awards at international film festivals because it damn well deserves them. It's got the less award-winning title of,
yes,
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Now, that obviously places it firmly in the US, but it's written and directed by Martin McDonagh, who has strong British and Irish heritage. And he's also got international form. One of his most recent films was In Bruges. It's pretty weighty stuff, isn't it? It's Three Billboards. It's the story of a mother, played by Frances McDormand, whose daughter has been rather horribly killed, murdered, and who's very, very aggrieved that the local police department, to her mind at least, aren't doing enough to track down those responsible. And so she hires, she rents the eponymous Three Billboards, and one of them calls out by name the police chief, Bill Willoughby, played by Woody Harrelson.
Yes.
And so the film, and I'm hesitant to use the word story because it's not a story so much, it's a phenomenal character study. But the film plays out as the response by Harrelson's police chief and the other police and the town in general is their response to her very, very provocative series of billboards.
Yes.
And
it's interesting, isn't it, Steve? It presents a flip between a position where they were all very sympathetic towards her, but once she had a go at the police chief, who everyone was quite fond of, sympathies turned around, didn't they? And so suddenly she became the butt of opprobrium, shall we say, at the very least, and people felt like that she was being unfair. And I think you're right; it is a fascinating character study. I was really taken with it.
Well, I think what you just mentioned is part of the crux of the brilliance of the film, is the fact that you can have a woman who is mourning the loss of her murdered teenage daughter and who yet manages not to be the focus of the sympathy of the town she lives in. There's so many contrasts and contradictions in the film. You know, like I said, it's not so much a story, it's a series of episodes and scenes where you've got weapons-grade acting talent being given spectacularly, beautifully crafted, phenomenally deftly written scenes that they can just completely envelop themselves into the most astonishing effect. It's just beautifully put together. And it takes you within a single scene or exchange from wanting to laugh out loud to suddenly being absolutely torn apart emotionally.
I think that I agree with this, a key point there that you've just made, Steve, about what this film's really all about. And it's a very insightful look at how someone who is grieving will not necessarily conform to a pattern of behavior that everyone else will think is, you know, the right way to go about grieving.
Yes.
I think it's a very individual thing. And someone, and we see the, as you say, Frances McDormand, who plays the mother who's called Mildred. Mildred is not a hiding a light under a bushel, is she? She's a
no.
feisty.
She is a powerful,
a strong,
strong
powerful,
woman.
A wicked sense of humor. Sure, she's suffering terribly, but she's not going to be trampled over, and she's going to carry on and to try to do her best to seek some justice for her murdered daughter. So it's, and then it shows the reactions, as you say, the reactions of other people to this dynamic. And particularly we see this character, a junior officer in the police force called Jason.
Oh, yes.
He's played by Sam Rockwell, who certainly at the beginning of the film, you know, can't abide by the fact that Mildred's gone out on a limb like this. And he takes some pretty violent and reaction of on his own two shoulders to put it right as he sees it. So
yeah.
His character is one of the key characters in the whole film. It's... yeah, and there's a lot of, I think the thing I found really interesting was the way that the writer-director, you said, as you reminded us, Martin McDonagh, how do you say that?
I'm going with McDonagh.
McDonagh. He, I think he's interestingly shows empathy for people you might not want necessarily to be empathetic towards, like Officer Jason, who was, let's face it, he's violent, he's a racist.
Oh, he's a thoroughly reprehensible character, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, but it's, we do somehow... eventually get on his side. That's a pretty good effort in scripting there.
It is. Madonna takes him on quite a journey, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say if I had any... there were a couple of points I just wondered to myself watching this. It's a thoroughly engrossing film, highly recommended, but the character, that Jason, played by Sam Rockwell, he goes on a heck of a journey, a character arc, if you like, from being this
yes.
rough, violent, racist guy into I don't want to spoil the story if you haven't seen it, but let's say his character changes a great deal. And while we are given particular reasons to explain why he changes, for me there was just a point in the film I thought, oh man, is that, how realistic is it that he could flip so much? But I kind of went with it because I think we were given a good reason for it.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed Sam Rockwell's performance so much I didn't mind really, because it was a great performance.
No, I know you're going with that. I can definitely see there was a certain contradiction in the character of Jason Dixon before and after a very particular message that he receives.
Yes.
And you can see the sort of the pivot point around which the character changes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's so much else that is almost flawless about this film.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you one more thing. Can I? What did you make of the humor? Because there was quite a bit of really excellent humor in the film.
It was astonishingly funny in many places.
It wasn't it, and I just wondered, given that it's dealing with the subject matter as it is with murder and grief, how did that sit with you? I mostly felt that it was just giving us a bit of light and shade as we went along, but. Occasionally, I just wondered, because people were laughing out loud,
yeah.
whether it almost detracted or belittled the seriousness of the other messages in the film. Did you get that at all?
No, because like I said, I think it managed to never let you get comfortable with the humour. Because
yeah.
every time there was a genuinely belly laugh moment, and there were many,
yeah.
it would then almost immediately pull the rug out from underneath you
yeah.
and say, yeah, you can laugh, but this is serious stuff. And it would switch in seconds.
Yes. I think, Steve, there was a absolutely brilliantly written and performed short little scene where Mildred confronts the senior priest.
Oh, dear Lord, yes.
And I think that was brilliant, because that combined both the seriousness of what this whole film was about, and it got some humor out of it at the same time. I thought that was just an absolutely stunning scene.
Yes.
Not a long scene, just quite a brief scene, but it was, boy, would they just A+ for that one. I'd go see the film just for that. It was really, really good.
Well, I mean, the obvious question that we always ask each other is, you know, would we recommend buying a ticket for this? And I'm going to ask you instead, are you going to buy a ticket to see it again?
Whew, that's an interesting point. Well, I was talking to this about this film to someone who's close to me, who's actually gone through the experience of losing a child,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered how they would react to it and whether it would be too difficult.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it would be difficult, but it also you'd get a lot out of it. And there's a lot of insight. There's a lot of empathy. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of resilience. And I kind of think, you know, even if I had lost my own child, the knowledge that someone else has looked at that and sort of knows what it's like and is trying to get that across is kind of a act of solidarity, if you like. And so I could see it again. It's not an easy watch, but it's beautifully put together and shot and directed. The performances are fantastic. So I think I could see it again. Yes, to answer your question. You?
I think there's so much in it that I have a feeling that if I were to watch it again, I'd probably find a whole new set of brilliances in it. I know I'm gushing a little bit here, but I don't remember the last time I saw a film of such rich quality.
Yeah. And there was just a quick little sidebar. What an interesting mix of music McDonagh used. He had classical and sort of operatics type, and then he had some banjo going and sort of more country music. And it worked. It was an odd mix, but it worked exceedingly well.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I cannot recommend this film highly enough. It's going to get Oscar buzz. Lady Bird, which is coming out very shortly over here, apparently is going to be its big rival. But I'm not sure I'm going to see a better film this year.
No, it's really, really good. It's entertaining, but also thoughtful. And, please go see it.
Do.
All right. Fantastic. Steve.
Simon, what's on your mind, mate?
Well, I thought that we should just change to another movie that's around. I mean, Frances McDormand is pretty well known, and there's Woody Harrelson, all big names. But if you want really big names, you don't get much bigger these days than Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, right?
No, I mean, we're going from... basically sort of character actors to these two, probably the two biggest film stars in the business right now.
I think that's a pretty fair... Well, Meryl Streep has no peer. So, yes, I think you're absolutely right. We're talking about The Post. This is from Steven Spielberg, and it's a... I suppose you'd call it a political thriller set in the... It certainly deals with politics, but it also very much deals with journalism, just as that very good film last year, Steve, called Spotlight...
Yes.
Which was an excellent film about newspaper journalism. So this is about The Post. This is the Washington Post. And this is set in a period before Watergate comes along. This is the early 70s. And it's all about the Post's efforts to expose the government and several governments of the time over what were called the Pentagon Papers.
Yes.
And I thought the film did a very... I think Spielberg deserves a lot of credit for the way he explained what the papers were in the very beginning of the film. I thought that was quite clever. He basically, we start off in 68, we're in a jungle in Vietnam. There's a squad of soldiers heading out, and they're accompanied by a bloke who clearly is not with the military. It turns out he's an observer, and he is part of this big academic operation, which is sanctioned by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, and who wants to plot and analyze U.S. military action in Vietnam over four presidencies, all the way back to Truman. And what he ends up with is literally thousands of pages of analysis, which shows that all those administrations, that's Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, right through to Nixon, basically lied to the public and to the Congress, and apparently broke various Geneva conventions about government involvement in Vietnam. And the key point was, all these presidents knew the war was unwinnable, but they kept sending more troops anyway. And I think one of the key facts the film reminds us of was that the main reason for this was not to do with protecting democracy in Vietnam or halting the communist march. It was all about saving face. And none of those presidents wanted to be the one who was going to be responsible for a defeat by pulling the troops out. It's a heck of an indictment.
Because thank God we've preserved the dignity of that office to this very day.
Well, that's exactly the point, and that's exactly why, in fact, it's exactly why Spielberg has got this film out. He's actually said in an interview he's rushed the film to production because he wants to get it out there while everyone's got Trump controversy right in front of them, front and centre.
That's not going away anytime soon, to be fair. So there's no need to rush.
No, but he must, for some reason, maybe he thought, I don't know what he thought, but he wanted to get it out there. So good on him.
Right.
So the story, I won't go into the story in a huge amount, but basically these Pentagon papers are leaked, interestingly, not to the Washington Post at first, but rather to a rival, the New York Times. And this film tracks how the Post tries to match and better the New York Times. And it goes through that. It goes through the Nixon administration's attempts to stifle all the press, and then to the resolution of the story, basically, which takes place in the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's got, apart from the aforementioned Streep, she plays the publisher of the Post, Catherine Graham. Tom Hanks is Ben Bradley, the editor, who was played by Jason Robards in All the President's Men, from memory, and he was also very good. And I thought there was a really lots of fantastic performances, a great turn from Bob Odenkirk, who I think we all see as was Saul in the lawyer Saul in
Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad, and he does a great turn as a reporter called Ben Bagdikian.
Yes.
So anyway, it's, if you're familiar with American history, Steve, I guess you probably know what's coming with this film. But I think the actors and the script writers do a very good job of keeping us in the moment. You know, the film keeps you on the edge of a seat like a good political thriller. So they do a good job with that. And all the time you're being, and this is where I just know what you thought of it, Steve. I did feel at times, how do I put it? There's some obvious messages here about, not rocking the political boat, that the big business are putting pressure on the media to not get offside with the president. Media owners in the past have been rather too cozy with presidents.
Yes.
And we've got this whole issue of, can and should the media break the law to hold to their mission of holding politicians to account? And then there's another really strong theme. I'll shut up in a second, Steve.
No, I know this film really spoke to you.
It did. And the other issue that's very relevant for today right now is that, and it dealt with Meryl Streep's character, Catherine Graham, needing to assert herself in this extremely male-dominated arena to see her will come to fruition. So there's a lot of messaging going on here. It's very obvious. If there was any, I'll pause for just a moment. What was your reaction to it? I mean, I'm a journalist, so I'm right into it. So,
I know you are.
But you might be coming at it from a slightly different position.
I'm you're a journalist. I'm an American, so I'm coming at it from that angle. and I think I actually, in some way, saw a different film from you.
Okay.
Because I'm coming at it from a slightly different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in some ways, I found that the first good half hour to be a very confusing and muddled mess.
Oh.
When we start off watching a film called The Post that's all about the New York Times getting a big scoop, you're thinking, okay, where's the focus here? Then it shifts to Kay Graham's concerns about whether she can keep the Washington Post afloat. There's an awful lot of kind of like insider trading, almost, if you'd like. They're talking about whether they should take the company public. And so there's an awful lot of that going on. And as long as that was at the front of the film, it was losing me, to be absolutely honest. It was only when, as you say, Bob Odenkirk's Bagdikian suddenly starts to pick up the trail of Daniel Ellsberg, played by Matthew Rhys out of The Americans. Once he starts picking up Ellsberg's trail and following him and starting to get the information, and then there's this huge, enormous drama about whether or not they can and should publish and whether they're going to risk contempt of court proceedings. That's the film that suddenly I really wanted to see, and that's when it really started speaking to me. Meryl Streep, I thought, basically dialed herself up to 11. She was so mannered and so twitchy and so hesitant and weak. You know, she'd pick up the phone and you'd expect her to hear, I think I'm on the telephone now. I mean, the whole thing was like, it was almost a caricature of the kind of portrayals that she does. Tom Hanks, on the other hand, was brilliant in the way that Tom Hanks is reliably and consistently brilliant. He really inhabited the role of Ben Bradley, but it was only when he started to drive the film that I really started to embrace it.
Okay, I pick up a couple of those points. Just on the first point about how the film started off in the New York Times, I actually did have the thought in that watching that part of the film, Steve, that if what you wanted to do was do a story about the media exposing the Pentagon Papers, you would have done a film about the New York Times.
Yes.
But I think Spielberg was, I don't know this for sure, but you wonder whether in the back of his mind he was thinking, yeah, I could do that, but it's the Post which went on to do with the Watergate scandal, and I want to somehow produce a film which sets the stage for that to happen with that cast of characters. And I just wonder if that was... Well, that thought was in his mind.
Given the closing scene, which is one of the most on-the-nose sequel setter-uppers I've ever seen, then yes, that's a fair comment.
Yeah, so I think so the whole thing in that first part of the Times has got the scoop on us and we've got to match them, that's a very in sort of scenario for journalists, right? It's probably not going to matter too much to the general public, but I mean that's undoubtedly what happened. But you're right, it's kind of it is a convoluted way to get into it. Just on Meryl Streep, I hear where you're coming from on that. I thought there was one scene which sort of redeemed her approach, which was near the end where she explained that I was and this was I think kind of relevant to the whole Me Too movement of today, of women standing up and being counted and taking accountability. She said, I don't remember the word for word, Steve, but it was a point. She was talking to her daughter, and she was saying, it didn't bother me at all that when my father passed the ownership of or the management of the company onto my husband rather than me, who was the blood heir, I'd never held a job in my life. She said that. She was someone who, from the upper American classes, lived a fairly cloistered life, not used to taking responsibility, certainly not used to running a business. And this was thrust upon her. And I thought that explanation saved it a little bit, because it kind of it went some of the way to explaining that sort of what you how you described it, Steve, is that kind of almost timid, overplayed timidity.
That's a perfect way of describing it, yes.
I hear what you're saying, but a little bit of saving grace is there. I just thought some of the grand speeches about the role of the media and the righteousness of freedom of speech, which we all, any journalist is going to agree with, I thought they were slightly overplayed at times.
Yes, they were a little bit self-congratulatory.
Yeah. And there was a particular scene near the end where we see Meryl Streep's character, Catherine Graham, walking down the steps of a courthouse flanked lovingly by a group of young women looking adoringly at her. It was a very contrived scene. It was effective enough, but it kind of almost made me feel like this was a righteous piece of propaganda.
When you notice the point that's being made as they're making it, and you think, oh, they're making a point, then the point hasn't been made well.
Yeah. And I think there is a bit of that there. So I enjoyed it, but it was a bit the message was a bit blunt and not that subtle or classy, if you like, in that regard. But some great acting and an enjoyable romp through what happened in the early 70s, that's for sure.
I think that's a pretty fair summation. So obviously, you with your journalistic pedigree, you'd recommend that anyone see this film, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think I would. I mean, I don't think it's as good as Spotlight last year. I don't think it's as good as All the President's Men. And can I just quickly mention one thing?
If I said no,
I'd do it anyway.
You would, wouldn't you? So let's hear it.
Well, I don't know if you noticed it. I think it was fairly early on in the film. We're following a character who's going into the offices of, I think it's a group of people who are whistleblowers.
Yes.
And there's all these movie posters around the wall.
Yes.
And just as the camera follows this character, and it just tracks past a poster of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Ah, I think I know where you're going with this.
Who, and of course, the Sundance Kid was Robert Redford, who played the Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward in All the President's Men. So I just thought, wow, that was just a nice little bit of placement.
That was not by chance, was it?
No. Ironically, isn't it, that there's... Yeah, anyway, I just thought it was just a nice little moment. I'm sure it was done on purpose, and yeah. Anyway, so I will. But are you going to endorse this film? That's what I want to know.
With minor reservations. If you like a good period piece, if you like talkies, and especially if you like Tom Hanks, and who doesn't?
Yeah.
I have one big criticism, though, and I just have to get this off my chest.
Go on.
Very, very first thing you hear in this film, the very first sound that hits your voice, hits your ears.
I'm just trying to remember. Yeah. We're in the Vietnam. Yeah. So.
And they start playing a piece of music.
Ah.
They play Green River by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Is it possible, is it even legal any longer to make a Vietnam War film without a CCR song in it? At least it wasn't Fortunate Son or Run Through the Jungle. I'll give them credit for that much. Yeah. Well, I've yet to see a Vietnam War film that doesn't have CCR in it somewhere.
Actually, you are absolutely right.
They always do. I mean, even
they
do. Do you remember Viet Cong Skull Island had Run Through the Jungle in it? They always do.
Yeah, they do. You're right.
But other than that, one little thing that's just becoming almost like an allergic reaction for me now. Other than that, yes, I think I would. I mean, it's got Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks in it, and it's directed by Steven Spielberg. It can't help but be good.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you that I enjoyed Hanks's performance more than Streep's. All right, very good. Anyway, so it's a pretty positive tick from us both on that one.
Absolutely.
Now, we better keep going with all these acclaimed movies, I think.
I think we should. Now, Simon, there's one film that I haven't had a chance to catch up with yet, but I know you have, is The Shape of Water. This is Guillermo,
I think.
My Spanish is not all it should be. Guillermo del Toro, we'll go, shall we? Yeah, him. He's often referred to as a visionary filmmaker. So how do we rate his latest?
Yeah, well, I rate it very well. And I've heard this term visionary often referred to him. I think that all goes back to that movie he did some years ago now called Pan's Labyrinth, which is a real visual spectacle. But he did the Hellboy movies, and in recent years he's done Pacific Rim, which is kind of a sci-fi blockbuster. And remember, he was actually in line to direct the Hobbit films.
Oh, yes, of course he was.
But then that kind of all fell over at the last. But anyway, look, this is a really... I've called this film a fable.
Okay.
Quite a dark fantasy. It's a romance. It's got thriller aspects. But it is odd, and it's wrapped up in a sort of almost like a classic B-grade Hollywood noir sci-fi of the 50s or 60s, which might sound all a bit crazy. It is beautiful to look at.
Right.
I found it really rewarding. So... it's set in Baltimore in the early 60s, and the main character is played by, I must mention this to you, Steve, played by the British actress Sally Hawkins.
Right.
Who you really liked, I think, in Paddington 2. She was the mother in the Paddington 2 movies.
Yes, she was lovely. She was a relatively incidental presence in those films, but, you know, what's the opposite of guilt by association?
Glory by what, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that. Whatever it is, we'll take it.
Okay, so she is the lead character here. She plays a woman called Eliza Esposito, and she is a mute, an adult woman. She's a mute. She shares accommodation above a cinema in downtown Baltimore, and she shares accommodation with a bloke called Giles, played by Richard Jenkins, who's a struggling graphic artist. And she works the graveyard shift overnight cleaning floors and toilets at a secretive government research facility, science lab. And she and one of her workmates called Zelda, who's played by Octavia Spencer, who does a fantastic job. We saw her in Hidden Figures.
Yes.
They come across part of the research facility, a lab or a holding pen almost, in which a sensitive asset is being held. And that is a aquatic sort of humanoid creature, like a fish man.
Okay.
Who's been captured from the Amazon. It looks like a man with gills and everything, can breathe in and out of the water. It's been captured by a security enforcer character called Richard Strickland, and he is played by Michael Shannon.
Mm.
Now, he is a rather brutal, hard man, and he keeps the creature under lock and key and under his brutal heel. So the key to all this is this all takes place in the Cold War. So the Americans are trying to find out what makes this fish man tick, and they're trying to find it out before the Soviets get their hands on it.
Right.
And so the thing that drives the movie along in terms of the tension is the American general makes the decision, right, if we can't have the fish man, no one will. We'll have to dispose of it. So the story is all about, will that happen, and what will Eliza, the Sally Hawkins character, do about it? Because she becomes incredibly affectionate and close and friendly to the creature, who responds in kind. So it's kind of a, you've got this cross-species romance brewing away. You've got the sci-fi elements of the creature. You've got the thriller aspects of the Cold War and who's going to get to the creature first. And it's all within the context of a beautifully filmed, the colors are very dark and rich, kind of a tone to this film from Guillermo del Toro. The sets are great, the costumes are great, the props, even things like buses and cars just look wonderful. And it's has this fantasy element to it, Steve, which I think possibly would be the most challenging for some people, because it takes you to, not everything follows in a sort of rational way necessarily. There's some fantastic elements to it, which some people might think, oh, that doesn't make sense. But it's, I found it very engrossing. I really got into the relationship aspect. It's kind of a love story. I got into that very, very nicely. Michael Shannon plays this hard-edged, hard-bitten government man in his usual almost terrifying way. And so if you treat it as kind of a bit of a fable, a bit of a fantasy, I think that's where you get the rewards from it. I think it's beautiful to look at. I'd go and see it just to see how it's put together and portrayed. It's got a fantastic opening shot. Remember, we were talking about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Steve.
Yeah,
the opening sequence of shots there was it was Three Billboards.
Yes.
It's just there they are. That's what the film's about, and here are the billboards. This film kind of does the same thing in a very nice, fluid, I won't spoil it for you, but it's a lovely opening shot. It takes you into different worlds, and it sets the tone of being something that's not quite going to be set in real life.
Yeah.
So I do recommend it. I don't think it's going to be everyone's cup of tea, but if you're into a bit of sci-fi, if you're into some fantasy and into a love story, this would be a very, very worthwhile watch, and I'd recommend it very highly on that regard.
I have to say, I think you sold me.
Good. I think you'd get something out of it. It's almost got a. At times, it almost feels a bit like a. It's a bit of Tarantino in it, almost.
Oh, wow.
That sort of, there is some violence in it. You know,
yeah.
It's got that sort of. It's not all lovey-dovey all the time. It's quite a challenging film. It comes at you from different perspectives, and I think it's very worthwhile for that.
I think I might just have to give that one a look then.
I think you should. But now, what I want to know from you, sir, is whether I should have a look at a film that's, I've been around for a little bit. I've seen the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
This is The Greatest Showman. It's obviously got Hugh Jackman in the lead. When I've seen the trailer, Steve, it looks like it's a drama.
Yes.
But I'm not sure if that's actually what you see when you go to see the whole film.
No, I'm starting to think the trailers are quite misleading on this film, to be perfectly honest. It's, first of all, it's a musical.
Right.
Let's be quite clear about that. The music is front and center. It's it's a story, as I think it's fairly well documented now, of P.T. Barnum.
Yes.
As he, quite abruptly goes from being dirt poor and the son of a tailor to suddenly being in a position where he can take over a museum, which he turns into a freak show.
Right.
And that's what suddenly gets him his fame and his riches, and enables him to provide the life that he always promised to his wife Charity, played by Michelle Williams.
Right.
Alongside him, he's got Zac Efron playing Philip Carlyle as his, what turns out basically to be his business partner. And in the background, you've got a cast of assorted freaks
Yes.
Everyone from Sam Humphrey, who is in fact a Kiwi, playing Tom Thumb. You've got bearded women, you've got werewolf men, you've got giant Irishmen, you've got, you know, a decent selection of freaks. You've also got Zendaya, the singer, playing a non-freak called Anne, who is a trapeze artist who plays basically the love interest for Zac Efron's Philip Carlisle character. And that's about it, really, to be perfectly honest. It's gorgeous to look at. It's absolutely beautifully put together. It's a very, very exquisitely crafted film.
Yeah.
The story is I was going to say nonsense. That's not entirely fair. It's ostensibly the life story of P.T. Barnum, but it's basically the life story of a fictional character called P.T. Barnum, because it bears very little resemblance to the actual Phineas. There was, for example, no Philip Carlisle. He's created from whole cloth. The episode where he brings Jenny Lind, the Swedish Nightingale, over to America to sing, and then she kind of screws him a little bit, really. That's based in truth, but in the end turns out to be largely a nonsense. So once you know the history of it, you know that really it's a work of fiction.
Right.
It's got a few catchy songs, and yeah, that's about it, really, to be perfectly honest. It is fun, but I saw it in a week when I also saw Three Billboards, and I don't know that it's entirely fair to judge any film alongside that one, obviously. But whereas Three Billboards will, let's face it, stay with you for the rest of your life, I actually, when we were starting to put together notes for this podcast, I was trying to remember what I'd seen, and it had completely slipped my mind that I'd even seen The Greatest Showman.
Okay,
well, that's the impact it had on me. So, are you a musicals fan, Simon?
No, although I one thing that just occurs is I still look back with some fondness on that musical from last year, La La Land. I quite enjoyed that. Now we've got another one, The Greatest Showman. I'm just wondering does two make a trend, or are we overplaying that thought?
I think you're reaching there a little bit. I mean, it's two in the space of just over a year, so maybe not.
Yeah.
I certainly hope not, because I wasn't that impressed with either, really.
No, well, I have to say, I would have taken some convincing to go and see The Greatest Showman, and after just hearing you, I think I might give it a miss.
It's perfectly acceptable for what it is. I have a feeling if you're the kind of person who'd wants to see it, you'd already know that you're going to see it.
Yeah. Why do you think then in the trailer they didn't show people singing?
Because musicals are horribly unfashionable. Who wants to go and see a musical?
Well, there you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, I can't add any more to that.
Yeah. Faint praise indeed.
I know. Anyway.
Moving as swiftly onwards as is humanly possible.
As humanly possible. Please, let's do that. Okay. Where are we? Oh, yes.
Now, Simon, we were earlier talking about The Post being brought to screen with the director very much having Donald Trump in mind, because, you know, what else would you want to think about? Yes. So now the veteran TV host in America, David Letterman, has returned to the small screen with the most astonishing beard.
Yes,
not quite sure what's going on there. But he's also returned with a chat show in which you might think that Trump, knowing his affection for the media, would want to be front and centre in his discussions with his very first guest.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the programme is called, it's on Netflix, it's a new series, it's called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction. And Letterman, who's 70, by the way, in these days.
That's still no excuse for that beard.
No excuse. No, it isn't. He scored a coup with an interview. He got Barack Obama. Now, I think this is almost certainly the biggest and longest sit-down interview Obama's done since leaving the presidency. It's about 50 minutes or so. So that's a decent interview.
Yes.
And I guess what do we want to hear Obama talk about? We want to hear what he has to say about Trump, don't we? Isn't that what the world wants to hear? I mean, what does he make of this?
I would pay good money to sit down with a beer with Barack Obama and get him to dish on Donald Trump. But something tells me he's classier than that.
Exactly. And that's where this is the double edge that Mr. Letterman gets himself into here. Whether it's because of the undertakings he had to make to get Obama to agree to do this interview, or because Letterman just admires Obama so much he doesn't want to put any challenging questions to him, I don't know. But basically, we got a lame and rather fawning interview, which covered topics that Obama has spoken about before, like civil rights. The interview was broadcast around about the time the Americans commemorated Martin Luther King Day, and there was a lot about the civil rights marches of the time, and that's all fair and good, and there was some quite nicely put together sequences of Letterman out and about talking to other luminaries from the civil rights movement. But it was very much how great Obama is.
Yeah.
And I guess the point here is, there's a couple of points. First of all, Obama probably, given what we've seen of him so far, would almost certainly have shied away from getting down and dirty in any discussion about Trump. I'm sure he would have seen, look, I'm too classy for that. I don't want to get into the gutter with Trump. That'll make me look like him. I'm a former president, and I still want to behave like as someone who's held that post. So I don't think Obama would have got grubby, but any journalist who had that interview would have at least wanted to be seen to be asking the questions.
You'd be trying to lead him at least, wouldn't you?
Yes, you at least you want to be seen to be trying to get something from Obama.
So tell me something. How painful for you was it watching this?
Well, it's pretty painful. I mean, yes, he is. You know, Obama is still held with great reverence, but you've got to say to yourself, Letterman is not a journalist. He is an extremely experienced broadcaster. He's done lots of interviews, but he was a comedian. He got this late night TV talk show program for like 30 plus years. He's done heaps of interviews. He's occasionally done quite hard interviews with people if he decides he wants to. There's one, I think, quite a well-known interview, Steve, the clips of it are on YouTube, where he grilled, what's that wannabe celebrity, Paris Hilton?
Oh, lordy.
She'd gone to prison.
Yeah.
But she'd come on his program to talk about some new perfume or something, and he just got stuck into about being in prison. And that was actually, that did make her squirm, and it was a good interview. But there was none of that here. So, in very many ways, disappointing. I asked myself at the end of this, does that mean it's not worth looking at all? And the answer is, well, no, I don't think so. If nothing else, you remind yourself how eloquent Obama is.
Yes, yes.
And you, I suppose you even need to say this, but it throws into stark chasm-like contrast what the gap there is between him and the current occupant of the White House. So,
Do you remember when we used to be an entertainment-based podcast?
When was that?
Good.
I know. That's right. Well, Trump is almost like entertainment. If we were Americans, it wouldn't be entertaining. It would be rather grim. But from this distance, you've got the American connection.
I've got the American connection. I still find him hysterically funny, to be perfectly honest. I did actually vote for Barack Obama. I did not vote for this Muppet. And since we are, as I say, an entertainment-based podcast, let's not forget, he is the greatest entertainment that America's produced in years. He's good value.
Trump you're talking about.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yes, like it's not, I suppose that's true. It's every day there's something new, so.
This is indeed true.
It's a gift which keeps on giving, as they say.
Yes.
All right, so that is Netflix. It's David Letterman. He's the first, this interview with Barack Obama is up there now, and the series is called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction. Apparently they're going to be 6 episodes, 1 month apart.
Oh, right.
Interesting. There's a lot of production work going on to each episode. Anyway, Steve, before we head off into the sunset, you have been doing your usual wonderful job keeping our cravepodcast.com website well up to date with musical and other events that are coming up. Anything particular we need to keep our eyes open for in the next little while?
Well, there's a couple of things to mention. I mean, I know that you'll want to be kept abreast of this particular one. So I mean, I know how you're looking forward to Mariah Carey's upcoming concert on her Number Ones tour, which is still an extraordinarily unfortunately named tour, but she's still coming, but she's pushed the date back. She's now going to be playing apparently due to a necessary realignment of her in that international engagements. Where are we looking at? I'm trying to find the new date now. I'm trying to find the new date. Bugger. It's on the website. I can't find it. Go look at the website. Oh, here we go. 7th of October. She's going to be in Auckland. So don't miss that. One by the kind of look at they're going to be interesting is a bunch called the Teskey Brothers from Melbourne, who are showing themselves to have sort of a Stax Motown kind of sound going on. They're going to be at the Tuning Fork in Auckland. On March the 1st, next night, they're going to be at Meow in Wellington. Night after that, Blue Smoke in Christchurch. They're going to be busy. So they sound like they could be worth a look. Let's see what else we got coming up, shall we? I know there's been a few notable announcements since last we spoke. Right. There's going to be a lot of the loud and raucous rock festival called Storm the Gates with some of your favourite tracks, Simon. Limp Bizkit, Suicidal Tendencies, all your very, very
my favourites.
I know. That's going to be the Trusts Arena on March the 17th.
Right.
What else have we got coming up?
Well, just while you're looking through, I'll just put a shameless plug in.
Go ahead.
Your wife Debbie, who did a review for us a little while back on the Justin Bieber concert, raved quite a bit about one of the opening acts from Australia called Shepherd.
Yes, of course.
And we've got the chance to interview the Amy Shepherd, the lead singer, and I'll be talking to her tomorrow. That'll be on our website, cravepodcast.com, in the next 24, 36 hours or so. So
it will indeed.
They are a really popular band on the up and up. Looking forward to having a chat to her. And if you get a chance, just have a look at the website in the next little while, as well as listening to this podcast. You can have a listen to what this band from Brisbane, I think they are, called Shepherd, what they're all about.
Absolutely. Another one that's worth mentioning.
Yeah.
I don't know how I don't know anything about this bloke. This is weird that he's managed to stay off my radar completely. Sam Smith.
Oh, yeah. I think I've heard of him.
Yeah, he sang a Bond song.
He did.
And that apparently is enough to justify a date at Spark Arena on 2nd of November. He's actually announced a second date. So take a look at the website and you'll find the details out for that. And then we missed out on Iron Maiden last year.
Oh.
Which was a bit disappointing because, you know, back in my teenage years, I was something of a fan. But all is not lost because the Iron Maidens, the world's one and only all-female Iron Maiden tribute act,
wow,
are coming to Auckland, Christchurch and Wellington on the 25th, 26th, 27th of May. So all is not lost. I will still get to hear Iron Maiden songs performed live.
Wow. And as we found out from that Eagles tribute band from several months ago, sometimes tribute bands can be quite fun.
Yeah. On the website, you're going to find reviews of a Led Zeppelin tribute act that Debbie and I went to see last year. And also the Bootleg Beatles, who were fantastic. Yeah.
So there you are. No, it can work. It can work. That's for sure. Okay. Well, fantastic. Thank you, Steve. So welcome back to 2018. And we would like to hear from you. So if you've got anything to say to us about what we're talking about, if you agree or disagree with us, you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook or you can follow us on Twitter @cravepodcast.
You can. So, I'm Simon Mercier.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Woo. Well, that went about as well as could be expected.
I think it did.